and welcome to the International Trade Resource Podcast, your go-to source for insights and information on all aspects of international trade. Whether you're an entrepreneur, a trade professional, or just curious about the global marketplace, we've got you covered. From customs regulations to export strategies, from emerging markets to international finance, we explore the latest trends and best practices that drive global commerce. Our host, Kim Kirkendall, sits down with a diverse range of experts who navigate the complex world of international trade and help you stay ahead of the game. So get ready to learn about the ins and outs of international trade on the International Trade Resource Podcast.
Hello, listeners. I'd like to welcome you back to another episode of the International Trade Resources Podcast. And I'm very happy today to have Andrew Jean Blanc join us. Andrew and I have kind of been in the same circles for a very long time, but only met recently in person within the last few months. He has spent the last 8 years in trade finance and international credit risk insurance, currently the business development manager broker for the Trade Acceptance Group, which specializes in EXIM and private trade risk insurance, credit risk insurance. Before that, he had a career in also in many business development roles, project management, and spent some time in China, which is kind of how we, and is an OSU grad, so from their Chinese language program. So we had a lot in common the first time we met. So thank you for joining us today, Andrew. We're glad to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me, Kim, and thank you for that lovely introduction. I was going to give you an OH, but I figured I don't want to, you
know. We don't want to get all the Michigan people riled up. Right? So let's start with, so credit risk and risk insurance is to help companies minimize the risks they take when they export and sell overseas. So first, let's start off with what are some of the risks companies face when they extend credit to foreign customers?
Yeah. So, well, I mean, one of the main risks and the primary risk that we deal with is the risk of non-payment. Non-payment could be a result of a credit risk or the financial conditions of the company that you're selling to. So there could be a scenario where they were to become insolvent, they went bankrupt, closed up shop, so you could protect against that with this insurance. There could be a scenario where they don't pay you for whatever reason, other than a, say, other than for a dispute, you would have protection there as well. And then the kind of the third leg of this is the political risk, you know, so that's more the country risk and the neighborhood risk. So you could also protect against war, political violence, you know, a loss that would have been suffered as a result of that. Currency inconvertibility, cancellation of an import license. So anything that would have caused you to not get paid. So when we're talking about trade credit and political risk insurance, that's kind of what we're looking at.
That's interesting. I think, you know, a lot of times companies hear about credit risk, you know, EXIM Bank, the policies and programs that they have, and they think about it primarily in terms of the customer defaulting or having risk, or they think about it in a very volatile political area, but they don't think about some of the other risk factors that you just mentioned. So, you know, very frequently when consulting with companies, we talk about ways for them to mitigate risk from a commercial transactional level, having appropriate contracts, making sure they've got payment terms that maybe accelerate the payment, or there's some prepayment before shipment. But those don't always protect the customer. And there may be an eventuality that they don't get either the balance of payment or the full payment, even with customers they've had multi-year relationships with. So can you tell us more about the insurance itself, credit risk insurance? How does it work? Is it rotating, you know, multiple customers at one time? Is it customer by customer? You know, how does it function?
Yeah, sure. So with credit insurance, you would apply for a policy. So there's a couple of different types of policies. You can insure a basket of customers or a portfolio of buyers that we might say, or you can pick one individual buyer and insure that. Now, depending on which insurance company you're using, choosing to pick one customer to cover may not be the most economically viable option. Fortunately, for when you're dealing with exports, there is the export import bank, which gives you a little bit more flexibility. If you're an exporter that's exporting US made, so greater than 50% US content products, you can potentially cover single buyer risk and not necessarily have to pay the minimum premiums that you might have to pay in the private market. So basically, whichever path you choose, you know, what we first do is we take a look at, you know, because we're talking about international, so who's the exporter? So we want to know kind of a little bit of a background, you know, your company's background, you know, what's your loss history? You know, what's your sales history? Do you have any credit collections background or any procedures in place? You know, it's kind of a little bit of a light underwriting on you as the exporter. Largely, you know, we want to see an exporter that has some experience in the industry, you know, 2-3 years minimum, you know, profitable. So once we get past that first hurdle, then it really comes down to let's look at the customers that you're selling to. Which countries are they in? You know, and again, kind of big picture, also what industry are you in? So, you know, then you're looking at, you know, the country risk profile. You're looking at just the economics, the finances of the particular buyer that you're looking at. So it's a little bit, there's a little bit of science and there's a little bit of art to it. But at the end of the day, you know, whichever insurance company you're working with, you know, they're going to have an appetite in whichever country you're doing business in, and they're going to have to be comfortable with the buyer that you're selling to. Now, one of the steps that, or I guess you'd say some of the resources that they may utilize to get more comfort with your customers could be, you know, your own ledger experience. So your own payment experience that you may have with this customer, trade references, credit reports. Of course, the holy grail would be financials. Those are typically the items that they would be looking at. And then ultimately, at the end of the day, when you're determining, you know, which policy type to go with, you know, the insurance company is going to determine what they're covering. They're going to say, if you're looking to cover $10 million of sales, they'll give you a premium rate and a minimum premium that would be based on that $10 million of sales with, you know, this portfolio of buyers. So then at the end, you'd have an overarching policy payment limit. That would be the maximum payout that an insurance company would pay for a given calendar year. And then you'll have buyer limits that would fall underneath that. That would be the maximum payout for an individual customer that you may have over, you know, a 12-month period. Of course, if you were to suffer a loss on one customer, you know, the third month of the policy, that credit limit is no more. So you wouldn't really have anything else to cover under it. But that's kind of generally the structure. You know, sometimes there's a deductible in the policy. Some insurers only write policies with deductibles. Some insurers have policies where they're underwriting every single buyer that you're selling to.
So that's great information to help, I think, our listeners understand what kinds of questions they may be asked, what factors go into the premiums they're going to pay on those kind of policies. The idea that understanding that it's not a blank check, that there's limits to, you know, so if they're in a very risky environment, they're not going to be able to claim again and again and again, because there are likely to be limits on that policy. One of the other things I think I'd like to dive into a little bit to clarify for listeners is, when would you typically steer someone to an Ex-Im Bank solution versus a private insurer solution? Like, when is one better than the other?
Sure. So, you know, Ex-Im Bank versus private market. Well, one of the first factors, and typically when we're working with customers, we're always kind of initially looking at things in a and an Ex-Im Bank perspective just to see if, well, first of all, if they just even qualify. You know, are they selling a product that has more than 50% U.S. content? Are they making sure that they're selling a product that is not military related or that they're not selling to the military? If they check those first few boxes, you know, then what we're looking at is, you know, what sort of volume are they looking to export? And also what sort of history, you know, is this a small company, you know, somebody that's new to export? If they're new to export, that's really when we're going to try to steer them a little bit more towards Ex-Im if they qualify. It makes a little bit more sense dollars and cents wise, just because, you know, newer exporters, folks that have newer relationships internationally, they may not have the best sales estimates. They may not know, you know, whether they're going to sell $100,000 worth of product or $1 million worth of product this year. So one of the benefits with Ex-Im is that there's a very low upfront cost. You know, there's an advanced premium that you pay. Sometimes there are some fees that you may pay to work with a certain broker, but pretty minimal. Other than that, you know, once you have a policy in place, you report and pay premium on a monthly basis. So it's a pay-as-you-go policy. So if, you know, 10 months out of the 12 months you have no exports to report, you pay no premium. On the 2 months that you would have exports, you would go into their system, you log in, you know, you put in your, you know, whichever customers you sold to, you put in the amounts, and then, you know, it'll spit out what your premium rate is, you pay the premium. So another benefit for some customers as well, especially if they're using this for banking purposes, Ex-Im Bank, because it's U.S. government backed, you know, it's a very high credit rating. You know, it's going to be a higher credit rating than what you'd get from any private market insurance company. So banks are very comfortable with it from a lending perspective. And additionally, you get coverage. Typically, you get 95% indemnity. So, you know, you only have, in every insurance that we deal with, there's always going to be a little bit of a co-insurance. So Ex-Im Bank is 95% indemnity with 5% co-insurance. Private market would be 90% indemnity with 10% co-insurance. Now, where you might want to make a transition to private market, certainly if you are selling products that aren't U.S. made, if you're selling products that maybe have some military potential use or you'd be selling to military, that would be another reason to look at the private market. But a lot of our customers are actually both exporting and selling domestically, and they may need the insurance domestically. You know, a lot of folks are using the insurance not just for the risk mitigation. It's also the added benefit is that, especially when working with some of these private market insurers, you essentially have kind of an outsourced credit department. You know, these insurance companies have very large databases, and, you know, they're making some of their credit decisions are automated. Some of them are, you know, directly from an underwriter. But the great thing is that you essentially get a little bit of a backstop. You know, so if you're a leaner operation, or even if you're a larger operation, you get some benefit where, you know, you get some additional protection. You know, you get some additional resources. An extension of your credit department, an extension of your collections department. So with the private market, you know, especially, like I said, if you're selling domestically, the private market can cover domestic. The export-import bank can only cover export sales. So the private market as well, it's also a little bit, I would say, leaner or maybe a little bit less, I don't want to say bureaucratic, but maybe a fewer or less hoops to jump through, given that it's you know, private enterprises, private insurance companies. So it can be a bit more responsive than Ex-Im Bank submissions. Additionally, if you have any super special conditions, terms and conditions, payment terms, you know, anything where you need really bespoke type underwriting or language, you know, within the policy, more often than not, really the private market's going to be about the only option that you have. So yeah, just a few considerations there. And then just to jump back to the kind of the way the premium would work in the private market, there are minimum premiums that you would have to pay. So whether you would be covering, you know, $1 million worth of sales, or you're covering $100 million of sales, you know, there's going to be a certain threshold that you're just going to have to be willing to pay in order to have a policy. So, you know, for the private market, you're typically looking at something in the $15,000 to $20,000 range. It can go lower for certain companies. And then we had briefly mentioned single buyer credit insurance. So in the private market, if you wanted to cover a single customer, there would be a minimum premium that where you're looking at, you know, typically it's going to be $20,000 to $25,000 at least. In order for, you know, part of it is really just getting it, the insurance company, I guess you could say, excited about the business, because at the end of the day, everybody has, you know, to make certain numbers, and they want to go for good risk and just general philosophy. You know, it's a little bit of my philosophy as well as a broker, but insurance companies in general, you know, people want to have a nice spread of risk. You know, they don't want just a concentration on one name. So that's why there's always going to be a preference for having as broad a portfolio as possible. But if you don't want that, you don't adhere to that philosophy, there are always options.
That's great. You know, great explanation. I would like to focus our listeners, I think, on the comparison that Andrew shared with us of not only when is EXIM possibly better for you, you know, or private insurers better for you, but how the process differs when you're going to those broker, you know, to the broker, or the broker's helping you choose between EXIM and private insurance. The process is different. The information they're looking for, the way that they're making decisions about the policy with you, how the policy proceeds, and your payments for the policy are different. So there's obviously quite a few differences between the private insurance and EXIM Bank insurance. Can you give us a few points for which companies can be denied, either EXIM, private, or both? Like, what happens where, because there may be listeners out there saying, I'm not sure my company, you know, I can't imagine us being accepted for, you know, insurance because our products we sell too infrequently or whatever. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the examples or situations upon which companies are denied insurance?
Yeah. So you're basically just saying where an insurance company might choose just not to work with them, or they might come back and say, yeah, hey, we can't approve any of the customers that you asked us to underwrite.
Yeah. And you mentioned, you know, military sales as being one of them. There are probably some country risk that's too high. You know, is it could potentially related to, you mentioned them being, you know, very short time in business or short time exporting, maybe their credit, they've had a history of collection problems. Yeah. What are some other things that might cause a company to be denied?
Well, yeah. So I would basically say, I think everybody saw kind of during the pandemic, there were a lot of PPE opportunities, and a lot of people, you know, got excited about the possibilities, you know, the potential income that you could make, you know, if, as a kind of a middleman. So, you know, we certainly had some folks come by on those types of deals. But yeah, you sometimes get companies that maybe they just don't have, you know, a lot of times it's that they just don't have that experience in the industry. And if it's an adjacent kind of industry, you can get through some of the underwriting hurdles, you know. So maybe if you're a logistics company, we handle frozen food logistics. Okay, let's start some distribute frozen food now, you know, internationally and domestically. Okay, you know, maybe they don't have necessarily the direct sales selling to the end users and the distributors in the frozen food space, but they've got a logistics background. We've had cases where, you know, it's like a logistics company where a couple of folks, they left a previous logistics brokerage, they started their own shop, but they had extensive, you know, background in the logistics space. So even though they wouldn't have necessarily met the basic sort of underwriting threshold of, you know, 2-3 years of profitable business, you know, they've got the experience, they provide their CVs, their company background, their work history, and insurance companies can underwrite them. We've had cases just like that. But yeah, so the instances when the companies will say, you know, we'll turn away a piece of business, more often than not, it's due to, you know, it's lack of information on the buyers. You know, they're trying to underwrite customers for certain limits. Let's just say, you know, had a case a few years ago, they were looking to underwrite some risk in the Middle East. And they're not super willing, in some of these countries, super willing to share financial information. So accurate, up-to-date information is very hard to come by. So, you know, unless you're providing it and you're really creating a path for the insurance company to underwrite the risk, they're just going to rather go another direction. So that's kind of a not uncommon scenario where there's just a lack of information, and maybe it's a result of, maybe it's cultural, maybe it's a regional thing where they just in general don't share that information, or it could just be, you know, it's a new relationship and maybe you're not comfortable even asking them for the, you know, their financials, you know, so maybe that's not the best route for, you know, so a lot of times if the insurance is the only thing that's holding together this deal, if you can't stand on your own 2 feet at kind of a starting point, you know, maybe on a smaller scale, maybe it's something you should look at other options. You know, you don't have to offer credit. There are other payment options. So those are a few scenarios. And then just, you know, the one that's not, that we've had a few times where, again, like just to kind of go back, recently had this with just folks just not quite having that experience, you know, just a little bit too green. And, you know, they were looking for export credit insurance, but they didn't even have domestic experience. And so that's a good transition point, at least in the conversation, is that there's so many US-focused, US and we'll say Canada-focused companies in the US that are, everything is domestic, you know, but they've got the track record, they've got a good name in the industry, and they're a little bit hesitant to maybe pursue international opportunities. You know, we work with a lot of those types of customers. Sometimes it's just starting with Ex-Im Bank, kind of getting the beak wet, you know, starting with a few names, a few customers, trying to insure those. But yeah, I think there's so much potential there just with US companies that are ignoring, you know, 95% of the world's population. So that's one of the areas where we kind of focus, because that's, you know, really aside from, you know, there's the credit risk protection, there's the underwriting, you know, sort of the collections sort of backstop that you get, you know, the information that you get from the insurance, you get the finance as well. But really the sales, you know, it can be a really good sales tool. It helps you be more competitive, you know, because your international competitors more often than not are going to be offering terms. And you may even have a scenario domestically where maybe you're a little bit tighter on terms and your customer has other options from abroad where they have, you know, more favorable terms. So it should give you some additional confidence and give you the ability to, you know, offer maybe more aggressive terms by utilizing the insurance.
I think that's great. I've seen companies over the years when the domestic business in the US has slowed down, it's really kept the company afloat to have those international customer opportunities, because not every economy peaks and valleys at the same time. So it can allow, you know, US companies, we'll talk about here, US companies to find an alternative market that will help them grow their business, potentially get new feedback on product and services, you know, that they might even diversify their business more than they would have if it was just domestic. The other thing you said that I was laughing, and I had my mic off so that people couldn't hear me laughing. When COVID first hit, everybody and their brother decided that they could somehow get PPE imported into the US when experts who'd spent their entire life doing that sort of thing couldn't get it. I can completely understand why insurance companies were not rushing to support that business. But, you know, it's a great way of illustrating how you're a risk if you're suddenly pivoting to a completely different business, completely different model, different customer, different product you know, regulatory issues or whatever it is. And that makes you a higher risk for the insurance company, you know, and that's just logical. But too often, I think small, you know, small businesses, SME businesses, they think about what their needs are. They don't think about how is the insurance company going to look at what I'm doing, you know? So as we start to wrap this up, can you share with us a couple examples of where, you know, on the success and the failure side of where having the credit insurance really protected people and allowed them to grow? And on the other side where, you know, it was able to backstop and protect them from a situation that maybe they couldn't have foreseen on their own?
Yeah, sure. We have a few success stories. I should say we have many success stories, but just kind of off the top of my head, you know, I was thinking of a company that we work with in the aerospace, kind of the airplane parts sort of space. And they got started working with Ex-Im Bank, very minimal sales. You know, we're talking about in the tens of thousands of dollars, you know, about 15 or so years ago. And they steadily kind of increased those sales. You know, they went from in the tens of thousands to the hundreds of thousands to the millions. And, you know, one of the things that really allowed them to make that transition was having the insurance as a backstop. You know, we've had a number of customers, and where you actually see this happen a lot is where these customers, these exporters, and again, this also applies domestically, but these exporters, you know, maybe in the past they've worked through a distribution partner. You know, they've got somebody, some kind of third party that's handling all their international sales, or maybe they're handling all their sales, you know, for continental Europe or something of that sort. And so, you know, something changes in the relationship, either, you know, maybe now there's a conflict, or maybe our customer, the U.S. counterpart, is deciding they want to get, you know, they want to have better margins and they want to take a little bit more risk themselves. So, you know, customers have used the insurance as a way to get into these markets where they've had some success indirectly, and they've used it to get into markets that are just completely new. You know, we also have plenty of customers that essentially they're kind of the, what's the expression? The accidental exporter, you know, where somebody finds them or they're found at a trade show and, you know, the opportunity is too good to pass up. So they become an exporter kind of by default, because there's just a very persistent procurement person from another country that's demanding their product. So yeah, we have customers that start kind of in those situations, you know, it's kind of incremental sales, and they start in the tens of thousands, and in the matter of 5 to 10 years, they're into the millions and even into the tens of millions. There are also, there's a couple of stories where it wasn't so much even the risk of the customer not paying per se. It was more so, you know, they happened to be selling to a sole proprietor, and, you know, they knew that the gentleman was going to pay if he could pay. But the issue is, well, what happens if something happens to him? You know, it's a sole proprietor. If he, you know, were to become ill or pass away, we need some protection. So we have those types of successes as well. And then you were asking about, in addition to those,
what are some of the, you know, not failures from the insurance company standpoint, but situations where the company maybe had the insurance, but they didn't necessarily anticipate a problem, but then a problem happened completely unexpectedly. Oh, I think it would be interesting for people to hear about some of those scenarios.
Yeah. So had a customer some years back, they were selling, I mean, it was a big multinational customer. And they, you know, they had a loss, I believe, in Europe to a longstanding customer, a rather significant loss. And essentially what happened was that their buyer ended up closing up shop because of some significant fraud, you know, some financial malfeasance that they would have never anticipated. You know, multi-year relationship kind of came out of nowhere. I mean, this didn't quite come to that, but you think of, you know, there was the scandal with Volkswagen a few years back that had a pretty big impact on its, at least on its stock price. But there's a lot of just unforeseen items where it's not even so much the, you know, the accountants and the finance folks, they might be doing everything right, but there are risks above and beyond them. You know, there's the political climate that, you know, just the country risk that you have to deal with. And then there's also the sort of executive type mistakes and frauds that come up that you're certainly not going to foresee. You know, another example kind of on a smaller scale was a customer, you know, you're talking about diversifying by selling internationally. And, you know, one area that certainly benefits from that approach is, you know, anything in the agricultural space, you know, because you've got Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere, you know, you can sell kind of year round, you know, so you can sell to Australia when it's, and they'll be buying when, you know, when we were covered in snow here in Ohio. But it was a customer that had, they were selling to a buyer in Australia, and, you know, they had those massive wildfires back in 2019, you know, so that was more of a, I guess you'd call it kind of a climate sort of a risk. But because of these devastating wildfires, you know, their facility was burned down. They had to close up shop, and it had nothing to do with the individual customer, you know, making any mistakes on their part. It just had some bad fortune. And so, you know, the insurance was able to cover that, in addition to just the bankruptcies and other claims that we come across. The unforeseen happens more often than you would expect.
And one thing I would add here, and then I'll wrap it up, is when you're doing business with someone, you're doing business with them, but you're also doing business with all of their suppliers and their customers and their employees. So one of their employees commits fraud, it affects the business. One of their customers goes bankrupt, it affects their business. One of their suppliers has a wildfire in their region, it affects their business. And all of those things can affect their cash flow, which can affect their ability to pay you. So, you know, there's really, we oftentimes, I think we oversimplify it and think the business itself is strong, but we forget that it's a web of relationships with a lot of other entities that can absolutely impact, you know, what's happening within that company also.
Well, and if I could just maybe add to that, you know, this wasn't so much of a credit risk situation, but we've had a couple of these scenarios where, you know, there was it was basically fraud, you know, where there wasn't that buyer to seller direct communication or relationship. You know, it was a little bit of almost the kids these days are swiping on their apps, and, you know, it's that really pretty or handsome profile picture. Maybe it looks a little bit too good to be true. You swipe and, oh my gosh, such an incredible opportunity. And, you know, it's like that old adage, you know, if it's too good to be true, it might be. But there have been so many instances where risk folks and maybe sales folks on our side maybe get a little bit too complacent, and, you know, they end up kind of getting swindled a little bit. You know, there have been cases where they think they're dealing with a representative of the company that's buying from them, but they're actually not. Or, you know, one instance just kind of on the cyber side where we have customers that have, where an intermediary comes in and changes payment details, the wiring instructions, you know.
I've had that happen with clients.
Yeah. So I guess to end the sermon, I mean, the main thing is, you know, stay in touch, keep in contact with those customers, because I know that the finance folks, the risk folks may not necessarily be the ones that have the relationships directly, but make sure your salespeople know what's going on and that they know the customer, you know, or at least are making an effort to try to meet them every once in a while, you know.
Thank you, Andrew, you know, for all of your words of wisdom today. It's a lot of very actionable content, I think, for our listeners in terms of managing their business. And really, credit risk at the end of the day is about optimizing and managing cash flow. so that your business stays healthy and can continue to grow. So thanks for being with us. And thank you to all of our listeners for being with us today. And we look forward to having you on our next episode.
That's all for this episode of the International Trade Resource Podcast. We hope you found this discussion insightful and informative. To find more episodes and more information on all things international trade, check out our website at www.intltraderesources.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and leave us a review on your favorite platform to help us spread the word. Join us next time for more exciting insights on the global marketplace. Until then, keep thinking globally.